You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret, and I love it when a plan comes together. That's the theme from the 1980s TV show The A-Team. Here's the plan. I'll tell you how the plan came together in just a minute. We want to hear from you about a TV show that you watch or watched that was from before your time. Something you watched maybe in reruns or syndication, cable, streaming, that was created, or DVDs, don't forget DVDs, VHSs, that was created before you were born, or at least before you started watching TV. Something that might surprise people to know, why do you get that pop culture TV reference? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. This may be a bit out there. I may not have been thinking clearly when I said this would be a good idea for a segment. I'm hoping you're going to join in at 800-642-1234. Okay, here's where this came from. Central Time producer Lauren Cox had sent me a note on Slack with background info on a segment for the show. I replied with a meme of George Peppard as Hannibal in that TV show, The A-Team, saying, "I love it when a plan comes together." His reply included the phrase, "I pity the fool," which Mr. T would say on The A-Team and elsewhere. But wait, Lauren is too young to have watched The A-Team growing up. So that's what got me thinking about these shows that we watch from before our time, surprising pop culture references that we might have. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You got one of these or a bunch of these? How about your kids? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's give a listen to one. Here's a show that I grew up with, right? It was, in my head, a new show when I was a kid. Here's a listen.
Some feline character. Could it be Catwoman back again?
Let's take a look.
The Cape Crusaders will try to head her off, Bunny.
Just 1 minute, Catwoman.
The nerve of her. Beatty Police Headquarters.
Yes, Robin. Gotham City may be in for some cataclysmic catastrophes.
Yes, the Batman TV show, part of my childhood. It began and ended before I began or ended. Your turn now at 800-642-1234. That show that you watch or watch from before your own era. Let's go to your calls now. Evan is with us in Bruce. Evan, hi.
Hey, how's it going, Rob? Hope you're staying warm today.
Oh, I will try. Evan, what shows are you do you watch from before your time?
So one I was going to say is The Twilight Zone. That's a pretty classic show. Lots of great episodes. And then the other that I actually watched during the pandemic was the original Star Trek series. And then I ended up watching through kind of all of those shows as we were locked down. Lots of really great old stories out there that are worth revisiting, I'd say.
Yeah, and had you watched later Star Trek's first, or was the original series your entry point during COVID?
I remember the 90s shows were on when I was a kid, like Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and those are pretty good, but I had never really watched the original series much until the pandemic hit and we were just kind of stuck, and someone who was really into Star Trek had suggested I go back and watch it, and it's interesting. It's kind of the original Star Trek series is quite similar to the original Twilight Zone series because it's just about weird things happening to a group of people in each episode. It's just the only difference is that in Star Trek, the characters stay the same versus in the Twilight Zone where you have a new set of characters in every episode, but pretty similar premises.
Yeah, and both written by some of the big science fiction writers of their time. How did they hold up for you, Evan? Did it seem old and cheesy and kind of ironical to watch it, or did it still hit pretty good for you?
Some of the Star Trek episodes can come off as a little cheesy, especially with how some of the special effects have aged and the color, but I would actually say the Twilight Zone, a lot of Star Trek still holds up, especially with the storytelling. And then the Twilight Zone, I think because it's in black and white, it just has a timeless quality. And it's really easy to watch those. And as long as you're okay watching things in black and white, those still have a lot to say, and they're quite good and entertaining.
Thanks for getting us started, Evan, at 800-642-1234. We are asking you to share your TV show that you watch that's from before your time, before your era. How did you watch it? I should have asked Evan how he watched Star Trek. Anyhow, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You weren't the first one, Evan, to mention The Twilight Zone. Phil in Woodstock, Illinois. I'll read his email in a minute. Let's get a taste of the Twilight Zone intro here.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Evan mentioned the Twilight Zone. Phil in Woodstock writes, I was born in 1983, but the Twilight Zone has always been a major part of my life since my family and I would binge the annual New Year's Day marathon on the Sci-Fi Channel when I was a kid. The spooky opening music, Rod Serling's opening narration. Phil says, I've watched every episode at least once. So when the 2016 election results inspired news anchors to say they felt like they were in the Twilight Zone, I understood it as fully, I guess, as my parents, who were toddlers when the series first aired. More than an amazing show, it's a 20th century cultural cornerstone. Yeah, I have memories going my way. I always have to like think carefully before I look in the rearview mirror in my car. If you've seen the scene, you know what I'm talking about. If not, check out The Twilight Zone. Okay, we are asking you to share the TV shows that you watch from before your era, maybe before you were born or started watching TV. You can join in at 800-642-1234. This is what we call a caller only. Unfortunately, our call system crashed there for a minute. So if you were trying to get in or briefly on hold with us, please try again. 800-642-1234 is the number to call or recall. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Asked around Central Time staff, Tim Peterson says, thanks to Nick at Night, I definitely watched some I Dream of Jeannie and Bewitched. Lee Rayburn mentions the Beatles cartoon show from the late 1960s. Yes, that was before my era too, and I definitely remember I had forgotten about it, Lee. Lee's right over there. Hey, Lee. I had forgotten about it until Lee mentioned it. It was a lot of fun. I want to go back and check that out. And on the Ideas Network Facebook page, we heard from Barney, who says Laramie. Now, that's a Western from the early 1960s. Cindy on Facebook says George and Gracie. That's the legendary George Burns and Gracie Allen. Hey, our phones are working again. Let's go back to your calls. Gage is with us in Madison. Gage, hi.
Hey, what's up? I just want to mention Cheers, coming from Wisconsin. I'm only 30 years old, so that show really resonated with me, even though it was well before my time when it came out.
Yeah. Well, how did you encounter Cheers, and how did you watch it, Gage?
You know what? I don't really know, but I must have found it on some streaming website, and I watched it like 5 years ago. So, man, I binged it all the way through. It was really good seeing Woody Harrelson in his heyday.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about binging Cheers because I was old enough. I was watching it on Thursday nights on NBC when it was on, so you'd get one episode a week. How did it hold up watching one right after another?
Oh man, it was excellent. Yeah, I mean, as soon as that main love interest of Sam's left, it was kind of lackluster. But man, yeah, it held up. I just kept going through episode by episode, waiting to see what happens between Sam and Diane.
Yeah, Gage, thank you so much for sharing that. That's exactly the kind of thing we're looking for at 800-642-1234. Eric is with us now in Fitchburg. Eric, hi.
Hi. As a child of the 70s, I used to watch Hogan's Heroes every afternoon.
Yeah.
That was a hilarious funny show.
Well, I was in a community with you then too, because I was watching it at the time, and it was the show actually aired, what, I'm trying to find it here, in the 60s, okay, before my time a little bit. In hindsight, it seems like a weird sell. Yeah, it's a comedy set at a prisoner of war camp in World War II Germany, but I don't know, I liked the show at the time. Have you ever gone back and watched it again?
I've seen it once or twice in recent years, but yeah, usually not. But I always remember just the kind of the silly things that they did and the humor behind it. So, yeah,
Eric,
good memories.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Yeah, the economics of this. So now you got streaming, so you can binge watch there. There were DVDs, there were VHS tapes. For a while, you had these TV stations called UHF stations. They were desperate for stuff to put on these stations. They didn't have a lot of money. So, hey, here's an old sitcom. It's got enough episodes. it's on. And that's how people like us watched all those shows. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Archie is with us in Ashland. Archie, hi.
Hi. I used to watch J.P. Patches from down at the city dump back in the 50s.
J.P. Patches. That is not a one that I... Okay, I'm looking it up. This, were you in the state of Washington by any chance?
I was in Seattle. I would have thought you would remember old J.P.
I don't. Now, do you remember Soupy Sales?
Yeah.
Okay, he was the more, he was Midwest based. He was based in Michigan, where I was from. So J.P. Patches, tell us about it. This was a regional show in Seattle, but it broadcast elsewhere too. What was that?
It was about a clown, retired clown from the Dingling Brothers Circus. He lived at the city dump, supposedly, and he used to have a lot of characters, particularly for a kid's show. He had more characters than most people. Grandma Patches, Grandpa Patches, Malcontent, the guy that did all the repairs.
Excellent. Thanks for sharing that with us. That is a new old one to me. Thanks for sharing that at 800-642-1234. We've got, oh, this is good. Dave is with us in Milwaukee. Dave, hi.
Good afternoon.
What is your show, Dave?
Perry Mason.
Perry Mason. So Perry Mason's the lawyer, right? When, this is something before your time. How did you find Perry Mason? How did you watch Perry Mason?
I just started when I was younger. I mean, it was before my time in the 50s. You know, there's, you know, shows that show these later shows on TV now. My, you know, MeTV, so, and Perry Mason. So I started watching Perry Mason. So
fantastic.
I started watching when I was younger, but one of the first shows I watched as a kid.
That's excellent, Dave. Thanks a lot for sharing that. My folks and my uncle and aunt, they get together every now and then. So one of them has the whole Perry Mason DVD collection, and they get together. It is of their era, I will say. Hey, we are taking your calls about TV shows that you have loved from an earlier era, earlier time than yours, something you watched maybe on reruns or cable or streaming, something that might surprise someone to know. Hey, how do you know that pop culture reference? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, take more of your calls coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You are our guest. Call in and share a TV show that you connected with that is older than you, a show from an earlier era that you got into or that your kids did maybe at 800-642-1234. I grew up with some Green Acreses and Beverly Hillbillies that were before my time. My kids, we showed them Buffy the Vampire Slayer. They liked it. They found Friends on their own. That was a show from before their time. What are yours? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Back to your calls now. Ed is with us in Northern Illinois. Ed, hi.
Hey, thank you for hosting creepy shows. And if you can find them, post them on your website. I didn't have time to look them up. So Twilight Zone, the one where the kid got stuck in another dimension behind his bed, Edward, and the antlered creep with an arrow going up the stairway creeped me out as a kid, and I can still remember him, obviously.
Ed, but I'll say, I mentioned the looking in the rearview mirror in a car for an episode, and wax museums I'm not a fan of because of the Twilight Zone either.
So if you find those episodes, post them, and then more people can get creeped out still today.
I love it. Ed, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Let's go now to Mike in Green Lake. Mike, hi.
Hi, how are you today? Beautiful show on old TV. I was a child of the 80s, but one of my favorite shows was made by a gentleman named Jerry Anderson from England, and he had marionettes with live action. The show was called The Thunderbirds.
I don't remember that show. Now, is this something you watched? Or was it on like PBS and that's how you found it? Or where did you encounter it?
It was on the UHF stations as
okay,
they were filling in. And I had no idea who this guy was, Jerry Anderson, but the shows, the explosions and the marionettes looked, they were modeled right after actors of the era in the 60s. And if you get to pick the show on YouTube or something like that, it's amazing the quality of the show and the special effects that he had and the explosions. And I guess he did a whole series of shows, with Thunderbirds and Stingray and Joe 90 with a futuristic show. So So there was a whole series by Jerry Anderson, and he also produced a show called Space 1999.
Oh, yeah. I remember Space 1999, and I got to say, I looked up Thunderbirds. I didn't remember the show, but looking at the dolls, the marionette things here,
yes,
that looks super familiar to me. That does ring a bell.
Excellent show.
Excellent, Mike. Thanks. Thunderbirds, thanks for sharing that with us. We are taking your whatever your classic TV is, a show that you got into from before you were born, any era you can name it, whether you're a young person now watching something from when I was young or, you know, earlier than that, you name it. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amanda joins us next in Oshkosh. Amanda, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What shows do you have for us? Oh, thanks.
Oh, gosh. So I grew up basically always watching old TV and still really enjoy it today. I always watched I Dream of Jeannie as a kid. Mm-hmm. Columbo has probably been a favorite of mine since I was 10, and I have 4 seasons on DVD. And my fiance and I bonded over Rockford Files and Twilight.
Ooh.
So being 34, they were all before my time, but the best shows ever.
I just got one more thing to ask you, Amanda. One thing that's bugging me about your story. So, sorry, that was my Columbo impersonation. I don't know if that came through. I'm really bad at impersonations. But I do have a question. Were you like watching this on like broadcast TV, or did you like streaming, or how did you encounter these shows?
Well, if you remember, TV Land was TV Land was the I Dream of Jeannie, and then there was, like, I think it was a local station, MeTV in Wisconsin, mm-hmm, showed Columbo, but now we stream Rockford and Twilight Zone. It's our go-to every night before we head upstairs and tuck in for the night.
I love it. Thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, that MeTV, that's, I think if people didn't get cable, that was a thing you could get on the broadcast. I remember in the early days of COVID, then producer Bill Martins, when we'd have our, you know, video meetings online, he would always have that on, and they'd always have Magnum PI, and he'd have it on unmuted. So I got to follow what Tom Selleck was up to in the background of our team meetings. Thanks for that call. We're talking about the TV shows that you watched from before your own era. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Jacob is on the line in Madison. Jacob, what's your show?
Talk about creepy shows. There was one called Lost in Space.
Right. That was one I remember seeing it. It was before my time. When did you encounter it? When did you watch it?
I think it was in the early 60s. I can't remember exactly, but I just remember some of the characters.
Yeah, who do you remember? I remember there were a couple kids. Like, they're all lost in space. There's kind of the cowardly scientist who always kind of made trouble, right?
Yeah, he was kind of creepy.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a rather strange robot.
Oh, that's right. That was Rob. Well, I know that robot. I grew up being called Robbie, was what people called me. And that was Robbie the robot, I believe, in the role as the Lost in Space robot.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Excellent. Right. That's a great one. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. I'll go next to Chris with us in Eau Claire. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What show do you have for us?
So it's SpongeBob SquarePants. And it predates me by almost exactly 3.5 months.
That's awesome. Now, SpongeBob had a long run. It may still be on. I don't know. When did you first get into SpongeBob?
Oh, wow. I think probably 2008. But we didn't normally watch over the air because we don't have cable. So I know back when things weren't as paywalled, we'd watch online. Sometimes if we were at a hotel and they just happened to have a live feed, we'd tune in there. And, you know, sometimes clips show up on YouTube.
Excellent, Chris. Thanks a lot. SpongeBob. Yeah, that's a great one. We are taking shows that you discovered from before your time. Maybe it's something your kids are doing now. How'd you get into it? How do you watch it? What appealed to you about that show from an earlier era? Call it at 800-642-1234. Paul joins us next in Eau Claire. Paul, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your show, Paul?
So, the Andy Griffith Show?
Yeah.
And,
that.
I was Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I was going to say, that was still on. I remember watching it as a kid. How did you first encounter it?
Well, I just encountered it. A professor of mine turned me on to it and just said, you got to give it a chance. And he was even part of, like, a one of the conventions and things of that sort. But it is so home, it's just such home, small hometown fun and just great morals. But, you know, just until Andy, just until Barney's gone. Once Barney's gone and goes color, it wasn't as good.
Oh, no. Okay. So the early, before it sold out, I guess, Paul. Thanks a lot for
sharing. There it is. It sold out. That's what happened.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Paul.
All right, thanks a lot.
Time for another call or two. Michael is with us in Madison. Michael, hi.
Hello.
Well, what, you've got a few shows to share with us, Michael.
Oh, yeah. Ed Sullivan, Perry Como, The Milton Berle Show, Superman, Ted Mack's Amateur Hour, the Life of Riley, Lampen to My Feet, which was one of the predecessors of most of the syndicated daytime television.
Excellent. Michael, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Some old school shows there for sure. We also heard, I mentioned earlier, I asked around the Central Time team. Emily Burdett remembers watching Frasier and Cheers reruns with her parents. I won't give her age away, but is younger than Cheers and Frasier, I'm pretty sure. And Sarah Hopeful says, I loved Dick Van Dyke as a kid and watched the DVD show on reruns. Sarah says, it inspired me to write a fan letter. I was so into it, and he even sent me back an autographed photo. Fantastic. Thanks to everyone who called in. This has been a lot of fun. You can keep sharing these shows, those shows from an earlier era, shows maybe from before you were born that you got into. Tell us about the show, what got you into it, and how you watched it. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up on Central Time on Monday, the grammar doctor is in. A grammar expert traveled the country with a roving advice table. She will share some grammar lessons learned along the way. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday. A Native American chef shares ingredients, recipes, and cultural traditions from indigenous communities in the Midwest and beyond. First, a recent report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum found local government debt is at record levels here in the state. The state's biggest cities had the most debt, but debt grew the fastest in towns, raising the possibility that someday communities big and small in Wisconsin might have to cut back on key services like libraries and police to catch up. Our next guest sees this happening across the country. He argues a big part of the problem is the way our communities are designed, saying things like sprawl and large-scale development have left us with more infrastructure costs than local governments can afford. In order to make communities financially stable, he wants us to embrace a more incremental, one-step-at-a-time style of development where small improvements are made over time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does development look like in your community? Do you need a car to get around where you live? Is all the new stuff a big development, whether it's commercial or residential, on the outskirts of town? Or are you seeing cool stuff happen in the downtown parts of your community? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Charles Marone is an urban planner and former engineer. He's the founder and president of the nonprofit group Strong Towns. Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
If I'm reading you right, you're looking for kind of a mindset change for how we think about development in communities, big and small. I want to start with what you see as the downsides of our current way of thinking, where we want that big new commercial development, the big new residential development, and we run our sewers and electrical out to it. Where do we start to go wrong there?
Yeah, I think this report too kind of highlights the signal is kind of the end game of this approach. What we've really tried to do is explain why cities struggle financially, because we have been conditioned to see cities that are growing and growing very quickly as being prosperous. If you have that new subdivision, if you have that new development, if you are getting that new big box store, your balance sheet looks good. You've got lots of cash. People are moving there. It's in a sense the place to be. But local governments take on, as they grow in this way, enormous promises for the future that are not reflected at all on their balance sheet. We have to maintain that road now. We have to maintain that sewer pipe. We have to someday fix that sidewalk. And when those promises start to come due, what we see is that there just is not enough tax base there. There's not enough wealth there. There's actually not enough there to fund all of those promises. And that's when cities start to get financially into a lot of trouble.
Now, you have some maps and graphics that I think were surprising to me. I think would be surprising to most people. You just looked at how much is the local government spending in a place versus how much is it taking in a place? Where are they making money? Where are they losing money? What do we learn when we start to look at charts like that?
It's amazing because this has been done. And there's a group called Urban 3 out of Asheville, North Carolina, that really pioneered this approach. Their principal is a good friend of mine. And we've sat down and looked at hundreds of different cities. And what we see time and time again is that the neighborhoods that were built prior to the Great Depression, and we can think of these as neighborhoods where people can walk. You don't have to walk. They still largely accommodate people driving and you know, modern American living. These are not places with horse and buggies, but they're older neighborhoods. They're neighborhoods built in a kind of a different way. They tend to be cash flow positive. Even when they're poor, even when they're occupied by very poor people, even when they're kind of run down, these places tend to generate more revenue for the community than they generate ongoing expenses. The further you get out from those core neighborhoods and the closer you get to today, the most modern stuff built is actually the worst. Over a life cycle, so not just, you know, the developer comes in and builds it and gives it to the city and the city has sent, gets it for free, but when the city actually has to go out and take care of stuff, the further you out time to today, the more cash flow negative it becomes. The stuff we built the last 30 years is financially the most ruinous that cities have on their balance sheets.
And people might hear us say the word cities and think you're talking about big cities, you know, huge urban metropolitan areas. You've done work in places like Lafayette, Louisiana, Brainerd, Minnesota, not tiny towns, but not your big sprawling metropolis. These are things you're seeing in communities of a lot of different sizes.
It's absolutely. I mean, I'm from Brainerd. Brainerd's a city of 14,000. The questions that I, you know, explore at Strong Towns came out of my work here and recognizing that we were doing everything we could to grow very, very quickly. But financially, we were just a basket case. We didn't have any money to do anything. We laid off our fire department. We were cutting back the library hours. We were doing all this stuff that affected people's quality of life. Yet, you know, we just heard the Foxconn update. We were doing our own kind of Foxconn things here where we were out chasing that next development and chasing that next big thing. This is a cycle we see in cities of all sizes. And what you get in a large city is you, in a sense, have more going on. And so sometimes it's harder to, figure out exactly where the money is sloshing around because there's a lot of different things. When you get into smaller cities, what you have is just a much more fragile system. Smaller cities have less fallback position. There's fewer Peters to rob to pay the Paul that you owe, in a sense. And so what we see in small towns is that the problems manifest a lot more quickly and a lot more urgently than they do in a large city.
We're talking to Charles Marone with the group Strong Towns, saying we need to rethink the way we think about growth in our towns and cities, big and small, that big project on the fringe may cost us more in the long run, maybe more than we can pay. That's part, he says, of what's driving many communities in Wisconsin and elsewhere into long-term debt. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest. Maybe you want to share something about your own local experience. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Samantha is with us in Menominee. Samantha, hi.
Hey there. I'm a big fan of the Strong Towns organization, and I was hoping your guest could provide listeners with a definition of the term strode, which I know is something that you guys have discussed as an organization, and how communities can use changes in zoning to prevent those kind of spaces from proliferating in our communities.
Samantha, thanks for the call. And that word strodes, I know you're familiar, Charles, it's street and road put together. It's big, fast-moving traffic in places like roads and places where you want streets where there's a lot of pedestrian traffic. Can you talk a little more about strodes and how they can cause trouble?
Exactly. We were looking for a word to describe essentially the most expensive type of transportation investment we could make with the least amount of financial return. And, you know, we try to draw a distinction between a street and a road, a street being a platform for building wealth within a community. It's the framework for creating a place is a street, and a road is a connection between places. On a road, you want to move very quickly. On a street, you actually want things to slow down so you can thicken the place up and actually get a really good return on our public and private investments. A strode does neither of these. A strode, from a public balance sheet standpoint, is a really expensive thing to build. You've got multiple lanes, turning lanes. It's also the lowest returning style of development. So you tend to get strip malls, big box stores, things that I think in our minds, we think, oh, you know, you're doing really well if you can get the Walmart. Sure, the Walmart creates a lot of tax base. It creates a lot of cash flow for the city, but it comes at an enormous expense in terms of sewer and water and road and pipe and all of the infrastructure you've got to build and maintain. And these buildings tend to last, you know, a couple decades, and then they go away, and then you just have the cost with no revenue. And so the idea of a strode is to kind of recognize this specific type of transportation investment and associated pattern of development as being distinct and different from what you would find on a street or what you would find on a really well-designed road.
Thanks for that call. Go to Dave now in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Dave.
Hi there. Sturgeon Bay just approved, I think it's about $700,000 to extend utilities down Highway 57 for the purpose of allowing a fleet farm development. And there's other areas in the city that have adequate water, sewer, and probably a better retail area. But they did that. And in addition, in the state of Wisconsin, we amongst other states, but we have what's called dark store property tax fights, where the big boxes can claim, despite what they sell for on the open market, and I'm a developer, I understand what they sell for, that the big boxes can claim that they should be assessed as vacant, which then is huge tax giveaway to the big boxes who are going to go where their sales are regardless. And then that tax burden, of course, is passed on to the average taxpayer because you still have to pay for services. And then, yes, in 20 years, maybe the market moves on and maybe that store does go vacant. And now you have a vacant store that hasn't even paid its share of taxes all along the way.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Charles, Dave, seeing the life cycle of the big box store, do you see that, a government subsidy for that kind of development that Dave says doesn't pan out?
No, it's a huge government subsidy. And this gets into the commitment that cities make. When we go out and build a road as a community, so our local government, you know, the board of directors, in a sense, directing our municipal corporation, our city, the community we live in, goes out and makes an investment in a road and a pipe and drainage systems. Those are forever investments. They don't go away. You know, it's not like you're getting married and you say, well, you know, for the first life cycle, we're good. And then after that, this is an infinite investment that we make as a community. We promise that we will maintain all this stuff. And often we go, and you see this with fleet farms, will come in as an example and build out, and we'll run the infrastructure out there, and then we'll keep running it beyond that. And so now there's people beyond that that are dependent on the infrastructure we put in for fleet farm to actually serve them as well. Then the fleet farm goes away, or the big box store goes away, or you wind up with a store that is a lesser use, a lower tax paying use, or you get the dark store phenomenon, which we can talk about, which kind of artificially lowers tax rates for these large corporations. What happens then is they, in a sense, as part of the marriage, can walk away, but we as a community cannot. And so this asymmetry of obligation is a huge problem that cities in chasing growth in this way don't often stop to consider. We're making a forever promise. They're making a short-term revenue promise on a building that is really hard to adapt and recycle to a different use.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Charles Marone, founder and president of the group Strong Towns, with us today. After a recent report showed local government debt is at record levels across Wisconsin, Chuck's group says sprawling development is part of the problem, causing financial instability for communities around the country. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Are you facing these questions in your own community, large or small? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about financial instability in our towns and cities, high levels of debt in Wisconsin communities and elsewhere, and whether the way we do development these days is part of the problem. Charles Marone stays with us from the group Strong Towns. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you want to share a story from your community, a question for our guest, what do you want to see local leaders look at when it comes to what to do with often scarce resources? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Chuck, you have a different vision for when local leaders sit down, community members sit down and try to figure out, hey, where do we put our resources to develop a community? What would you like to see it look like?
Well, at the end of the day, if we're trying to make good financial investments, investments that actually make our communities wealthier, lead to a higher quality of life, lower tax rates, that kind of thing. Those investments don't look like the big project. Those investments tend to look more like a collection of smaller things. When we can thicken up our neighborhoods, when we can take and add more ratepayers to a segment of pipe, add more units of housing to a neighborhood, when we can get that old store that's on the existing system that's kind of in a rundown state, built up a little bit and reactivated and a new business in there. Those things tend to cost very little in terms of capital, but have an immense effect on the overall tax base. If we can grow our tax base by 5% over what just general inflation will be, our communities will get rich. I mean, they really will start adding a lot of wealth without adding any additional expense, really. And you know, if we look at, I don't think we should think of cities as a business, but cities can use business principles to understand what is going on in them. And if we think about it for a moment in that way, what we find is that the quality of life things, making your parks better, adding street trees, making it easier for people to bike and walk, these are actually the best financial investments that we can make in a place because they're relatively cheap and they spread out a lot of wealth or a lot of value increase over a really broad area, which is, you know, ultimately what you're trying to do.
It seems like there's a certain political incentive to go in the other direction. If I'm a politician, I could show up at a ribbon cutting for the new development or the new bridge or what have you. I can't show up at the ribbon cutting to fill that pothole or plant that tree. It doesn't sound as exciting.
It's funny because the local politicians that do this really well, they have ribbon cuttings every day, you know, for filling potholes and fixing up the park and planting trees. They just do it differently, right? They're very smart about it. And in a kind of a social world, you know, where we use social media, it's one of those things where instead of having the one big event during your administration, you've got 1,000 small ones, and it's much more effective politically. I think the political problem, if we want to talk about it, is the way that the state and the federal government approach these things. I mean, you do have when the state of Wisconsin gives cities monies to build infrastructure or helps subsidize that approach, when the federal government does likewise, when we have artificially low interest rates, what we wind up doing is encouraging cities, giving them massive incentives to do these things that are in short-term interests of the state and federal government. State government makes their money off of income tax. They make their money off of sales tax. So transactions are really great for them. Same with the federal government. What they don't do, either the state or federal government, is take on that long-term promise to fix that street, to maintain that pipe. So what you have is a system where the dialogue, the conversation, the incentives, the way we even talk about this from a top-down standpoint, is all about the next big project that we can do. That's really not in the interests of cities. It's not in the interest of local governments, and it's not in the interest of the people who live in them.
On the demand side of things, I think there's a notion about Americans, maybe a caricature, that we don't want denser development, taking more intense advantage of our local infrastructure. We want to live away from downtown. We want to drive to that big box store and park in the parking lot with plenty of spaces for us to park in. True or false?
I think that there is a big element of truth to that. But it's always important to point out that all of these things come at a price point. The most expensive real estate in North America is in Manhattan. New York City and San Francisco, two of the densest cities in the United States. If you go and talk to people there, they will tell you that they like living there. They want to live there, and they're willing to pay high amounts of money to do that. I think if you have very nice places, if you have places where the parks are well-maintained, the sidewalks are well-maintained, there's great street trees, you've got good urban design, people tend to prefer those places over the more windy, cul-de-sac-y, beige-ish, kind of development every day. There's a huge premium that people will pay to live in those type of complete neighborhoods, a neighborhood with a coffee shop up the street and a local butcher and a local florist and all these things. That used to just be development. That used to just be how we built things. I think that there's a stated preference today, perception, because that is the only thing that the market really creates. And every time we see something different created in the market, we see it gobbled up faster than it can be built at a premium price.
On the other hand, I've kind of pointed toward the opposite political view. I think most people want their water to work and their electricity and their roads to not have potholes and things like that. How can we, I guess, develop that as a constituency if that's the kind of thing we want?
Well, and most people want their taxes to be low or reasonable. And most people want, there's a whole list of things in terms of, just the core competencies of government that people expect. I think it's important to recognize that the people of Detroit did not wake up one day and decide that they didn't care how their local government ran. It just slowly fell apart. We have had this introspection this year about Jackson, Mississippi and their water problem. That did not develop in the last 6 months. That's been a slow rolling disaster over a long period of time. When we step back and we look at cities across North America, when we look at cities across Wisconsin, what we see is this same kind of slow building disaster taking place in each and every one of them. It's not because they're poorly run. It's not because the people there are incompetent or greedy or short-term. It's because the underlying development model is the same development model that bankrupted Detroit. It's the same development model that has bankrupted Jackson, Mississippi. And it is slowly grinding all of these cities down. And what you see as a result is higher taxes, lower levels of service, and growing levels of debt. And this most recent report just kind of affirms that this is the overall trend that we see in our cities. It's just another data point to kind of affirm the fact that this development model is not working long term for our local governments.
Chuck, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. You take care.
You too. That's Charles Marone, founder and president of the group Strong Towns, with us today to make the case for a return to incremental development, smaller scale development in towns and cities after a recent report showed local debt at record levels in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. A chef based in the Midwest joins us to talk about indigenous cooking traditions and their relevance to our culture and health and the food we eat. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.